You're listening to CKUT. The following is a previously broadcast program. Stay tuned.
Good night, good night, good night. To everybody out there, to Radio Land. This is The Sound of Soul with your host, Butcher T. Filling in for the band, Ricky D.
Oh my god.
All right, hello everyone. Sorry for the delay there. You are listening to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. This is a news show run by the News Collective for the first Friday of every month. We are live in the studio today with some special guests, and I'll get them to introduce them in a second. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about the recent blockade at the Bronfman Building and also about Palestinian activism on campus at large. So we have four guests in studio, and they're all going to be using pseudonyms for anonymity reasons. So if you guys could introduce yourselves and which organization you're from, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Micah, and I'm here on behalf of IJV, Independent Jewish Voices McGill.
Hey, everyone. It's Layla from SPHR McGill.
I'm Sarah.
And I am Catherine.
And we're here from Grad Students for Palestine.
And for listeners who aren't familiar, could you guys give us just like an overview of what happened last Thursday, February 22nd, outside the Bronfman Building? Why were you outside his hotel, Bronfman Building, and what were your demands?
Yeah, so the gist of it was that for the entire day, last Thursday, students from a variety of organizations, from IJV, from SPHR, from Divest, and from grad students, targeted the Bronfman Building for a total shutdown. And so what this looked like is that picketers were there from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m., disrupting regular academic activities and stopping students and professors from entering the building. And this choice, like as you alluded to, of building and of department was very intentional. The Des Hôtels department offers a number of courses, specifically ORGB and FINE 434, which are courses that involve an exchange program, a highly subsidized trip to Israel. And these courses, not only are they facilitating this exchange program, they also are really heavily subsidized by a donor by the name of Heather Reisman, who also funds an organization called the Hesseg Foundation, some of you might be familiar with it, which gives money to Canadians to join the Israeli Defense Force, something that's illegal in Canada to give money to incentivize to join a foreign military, and something, of course, that's extremely disturbing and should be ended. And so we were protesting this program in specific, and our demands were that this program was ended as soon as possible, immediately.
Yeah, I mean, so there's also, so you mentioned the topics in finance course, and then I saw elsewhere also the FACC 501 Technology Business Plan Project, an experiential trip to Israel. Again, this like startup nation kind of course. And then also like the exchanges with Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University, I believe. Would you guys want to speak to those kind of academic exchange programs as well?
Yeah, so FACC 501 is in the same family as the as the ones we mentioned. These courses that use this terminology, referring to the Zionist regime as a startup nation, under this idea that that's the highest concentration of startups in the world. Of course, obscuring the fact that it's a settler colonial state and a state that's perpetuating a genocide. And so we're also, by virtue of protesting the Desotel courses, protesting the course that's run through engineering. And many of these courses are also partner with Hebrew University and Tel Aviv University, which I think maybe I'll invite someone else to speak a little bit more about.
Yeah, so academic institutions within Israel can't be disentangled, like, from the occupation. They are heavily complicit in the war crimes that the Zionist state is responsible for. So besides just the fact, like, besides the research and development happening within these institutions contributing to Israel's military aggression against Gaza and the West Bank, we think that any type of partnership normalizes their complicity with the Israeli regime.
So at this point in time, the Palestine Solidarity Referendum is under review, and there's been months of protests on campus. Why did your coalition of student groups for Palestine decide that a physical blockade was the needed move at this moment? What's the strategic move here?
So I think it's important to point out that this action did not happen in isolation. There's been a history of student activism that went through all of the legitimate means that the university offers us to express our discontent. There have been multiple referendums in the past, right? This is not the first one, and there's been multiple legal injunctions. And it's also important to note that although the university has critiqued us for the particularly disruptive nature of the protest, you know, many academics, including a survey that showed that 7 out of 10 academics in a Guardian article agreed that disruptive protests are shown to be much more effective at advancing the causes. And it was the only option in many ways, I believe, that was left to us.
Yeah, and as Mika just kind of pointed out, McGill effectively loses any authority they have to condemn a disruptive action when they refuse or like choose to not only not pay attention to the legitimate avenues that have been successfully pursued, but also go out of their way to undermine their own systems of student democracy that they've set up for people to voice these opinions. So their opinion isn't, it's maybe has never been valid, and it's certainly not valid at this point in time.
So obviously this blockade took place outside of Desotel building when there were classes that were slated, you know, to be planned for that day. How did you deal with Desotel students and, you know, like, and faculty? How did they react to the blockade? And, like, what kind of conversation were you having? What would you say to them, I guess?
Yeah, so the earliest hours were the most tense, I'd say. So between the hours of like 8 to 10, I think that's when the confrontations were like the nastiest. There were cases of like harassment and like clear cases of like physical harassment from professors.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, it was, my God, I didn't know that.
And it was the same ones hitting every door. Like, they were relentless, you know? Yeah. So that happened again in the early mornings. I think with, like, regarding students, as soon as that email was sent out, like, the picketers had a really strong defense. Like, immediately they just referred students to the emails, and there was kind of no conversation past that. Of course, there were confrontations with the students who were particularly aggressive, had an agenda. So they weren't just super passionate about their class. They were passionate about breaking the picket for a political reason. So, yeah, I'd say overall, though, I think after the email was sent, as, like, the picket was super, like, consolidated during the morning, it got really, like, it got a lot better. And, yeah, but our picketers took a lot of, like, smack, and they held up their line pretty well. And, yeah, it was good to see them super committed.
Yeah, and we've been trying to kind of protect the safety of the picketers, so we haven't been releasing a lot of this information about the specific concerning cases of harassment from Des Hôtels professors. But I think it is really important that the people in administration are aware of this type of behavior, and I think moving forward, we're definitely going to address that.
Yeah. Did you have any, like, conversations with Des Hôtels students who were like, oh, I didn't know about this? Like, did you, like, was there any kind of, because, yeah, I feel like that happens a lot with picket lines, you know, like, you'll kind of just get people who are just going about their day-to-day business. Like, what was that like?
We did have a couple of interactions where people would show up and ask us what was going on, and we got to explain, and it was, a lot of those conversations went really well, and it was sort of a encouraging set of interactions to have. We had some conversations with people who had wanted to try to force their way into the building, and we had explained the reasoning behind the picket and why we thought it was important they didn't, and we were able to convince people. And, like, it's great to have those sorts of interactions.
Yeah.
And with a couple of exceptions from people who were, I think, trying to start trouble, the interactions we had with students were generally better than the interactions that we had with profs and staff, who were generally much more combative.
Yeah, and I mean, and on the other side of things, you know, even on, like, the posts, like, the original Instagram posts, you know, you saw a lot of comments criticizing the blockade, saying, I just want to go to class, like, great job, you disrupted the campus, what did that even do? And then there's also the second line of criticism, which is, And we saw this, like, a lot, like, in Canadian politics too, like with the Indigo vandalism, saying, well, you're just vandalizing, protesting outside all these, like, Jewish institutions, that's anti-Semitic. What do you, you know, like, what, how do you respond to like those kind of criticisms?
I mean, I think when we're going to address those comments, I think we need to know off the bat they are in bad faith, because it is a intentional, like, misconstruement, misinterpretation of what are extremely clear intentions of a group that is interdisciplinary and has Jewish volunteers at its forefront and deeply, you know, motivated and deeply a part of that effort. And, like, I definitely saw those comments that you alluded to as well. Things like, oh, they probably didn't know who Bronfman was. Like, I bet they were so surprised to figure it out. And we're like, no, we are aware of the legacy of the Zionist Bronfman family and their complicity in genocide. But, like, our effort here as students at this building is because of the faculty housed within it and a unwillingness to perceive what are extremely clear intentions that we are handing out in literal pamphlets is, I'm afraid, a lack of critical thinking and has nothing to do with religion. Absolutely nothing to do with religion. So I would say it's an unfortunate conflation, but it needs to be said, Judaism is not Zionism.
And there was even a speech at the rally itself by a member of Independent Jewish Voices that that, like, particularly engaged with the Bronfman family, their role in setting up the Zionist propaganda birthright trips and kind of their continual role in propping up Zionist ideology.
Yeah, absolutely. The Bronfman family had a, you know, outsized role in the Zionist Canadian scene for generations, creating the birthright trip, as Sarah alluded to, and the elder Bronfman donated, I believe, billions of dollars to the Israeli occupation forces during the Nakba, which I believe was against international law at the time.
Wow.
So if you're going to critique us for going after somebody who, you know, is just, you're saying they're, because they're Jewish, I think you should understand the actual legacy of those individuals and understand that those are political actions, those are financial decisions, which have real life consequences, which, you know, can be construed through the lens of religion, but that is not the main intention.
Yeah. Very well said. Speaking of criticisms, during the blockade, there was a counter-protest that emerged across the Bronfen building. Mm. What was the dynamic like, and how did it feel for you guys to see that?
So it was quite a pathetic bunch of, like, 12 Zionists on campus. Their agenda was, we will blast shitty music on top of indigenous elders as much as we can. So we brought the Mohawk Mothers, as we like always love to do, and it's always really great to hear their perspective. And they like never failed to do the whole transnational solidarity thing. And so they were giving a speech about how it was Palestinian activists who brought it to their attention that McGill had like a lab for like arms manufacturing. And throughout that entire speech, the elders had to speak over music that was blasting over their speakers. And it was just a disgrace to see it happen. But yeah, I mean, there wasn't much of the dynamic wasn't quite confrontational, because by then the police had been like, had flooded the scene and was like clearly separating the protest. And at one point when their speaker died out, they kind of lost, you know what I mean? Like, they lost their presence, and we kind of like took over the scene, but yeah.
Can I add, I was like there, and there were so many police at one point, and like even two like RCMP officers on horses I saw came, and then when they left, there was like a pile of like horse poo.
Oh, no.
I just thought it was like so, like, disrespectful to even, like, oh my god. It was so, I thought that was a very fitting image for their presence there.
Yeah, I think at the height of the police response around 2 p.m., we saw, like, over 15 police cars, 3 riot vans, 2, as you mentioned, the police on horses, an arrest van, so, like, one of those minibuses, around 20 officers, and then around 15, like, riot-specific police. So that was really disturbing and concerning, not only to see them on campus, but to see how McGill administration was inviting them and agitating them and encouraging them, and how they were trying to escalate with the blockaders and with the picketers themselves as well, try to elicit a response, of which they were like unsuccessful. But
For sure. And at one point, McGill, in our communications with them, had essentially like promised that like the police presence would decrease and no one would be bothering us, like, and then they would leave. And what essentially, like, what that did was essentially, like, let the cops reign in whatever capacity they wanted over, the protesters. So it was precisely then that, like, I think the police violence, like, escalated. And we had, like, students get shoved, like, to the ground. We had, like, girls, like, 5'2", 4'11 girls get, like, shoved to try to get a reaction out of them. And the presence as well, like, I think, like, increased, like, the call presence. So I think it was pretty irresponsible, like, on the admin's part to just, like, allow that free reign to take over.
Yeah, very dangerous escalation from McGill administration in how they deal with peaceful protests on campus.
Yeah, well, the next thing I want to turn to is a little bit of a close reading of the latest email from the administration that got sent out to all students on campus. So this past Monday, McGill President Deep Saini wrote a McGill-wide email in response to the blockade. He wrote, quote, "McGill will not unilaterally sever its research and academic ties with its with academic freedom of individual members of the university community to engage or partner with an institution simply because of where it is located. To do so would be wholly opposed to our institutional principles." So obviously, I mean, they're engaging with your demands, actually. But, you know, this argument against an academic boycott as academic freedom and discrimination based on location, like, what do you make of that statement?
Yeah, so I think that completely sanitizes, I mean, the country of target, or like the entity of target. I mean, we're talking about a state that's committing an active genocide, and I just think it's really convenient to frame it as like we are isolating a specific state without intention, when there's like a clear list of demands being accompanied and like a very clear context that is associated with this call for a boycott. As for like McGill's declaration that it will not unilaterally divest, I mean, we know it's a process and we're going to keep pushing, and I don't think it's intimidating to hear what we already know is their stance.
Saini also wrote that the blockade, unlike past protests for Palestine on campus, violated the code of student conduct and disciplinary procedures, and that, quote, in any future instance where obstruction to university activities or any other breach of our policies occurs, the application of the protocol for addressing campus disruptions referred to above will be swift. Mm-hmm. How did you guys interpret these statements?
I mean, it's a pretty clear threat that if something like this gets attempted again, they will try to arrest us. I don't know if I buy it as a serious threat. I think that Deep Saini should be much more afraid of the image of me getting arrested on campus than I would be. I don't think that that's a win for him. Mm-hmm. And I think that he knows it. Mm-hmm. But it is a threat that we will be arrested for speaking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it speaks to how unprepared they were that day. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it was, they had zero protocol established. They had no idea how to handle it. And I think this is them, like, kind of, like, internalizing that, like, anxiety that they were put in. So I think it is, like, a lashing out, like, really, like, strong threats. Like Catherine said, like, I don't know if, like, mobilizers, like, on campus are necessarily intimidated by the threat. With regards to, like, the statement that this was a violation of the student code of conduct, everyone went into that knowing this. So everyone knew what they were facing. And I think at this point, there's just, like, such a huge moral imperative that, like, it doesn't matter. And, yeah.
Just one thing I wanted to add is in the 80s, when students on the McGill campus were also engaging in similar BDS-style actions, the university, again, condemned them, said it was against their code of conduct, did everything they could to stop this mounting pressure, which culminated, to my understanding, in an occupation of the administration building. And they were successful in their eventual efforts in getting the university to divest completely from apartheid South Africa. And I mean, I can't predict the future, but we're sort of getting that sort of desperation, as Layla said, that anxiety from being really unprepared. And we kind of caught them off guard. And you can really see that when Saini says, but that day was different. You know, I've never seen that sort of language from the eloquent desk of the provost.
And also, like, don't let the president tell you that he speaks for McGill and you don't. Without him, we might have a badly managed institution, but without us, there is no school. And the message that he isn't ready to divest yet is, like, it's less important than the message that so many people are. We heard from so many people in the community, profs, students, alumni were reaching out to us. People from all parts of McGill were telling us that they were glad that someone's making a statement that's so hard to ignore.
Yeah, I mean, just, like, on that, you know, like, the disciplinary kind of reaction. I mean, where do you guys think the line is between what is an acceptable protest and what is not, like, in the admin's eyes? You know, like, it's just because, you know, I feel like we do see pickets quite a bit. And we've seen, like, kind of disruptive protests on campus, like, within the year, but also within, like, you know, the past decades. Like, what do you guys make of that line, I guess?
So I think, I mean, the subject being for Palestinian liberation, I think speaks a lot to what the threshold for admin is. So I think our threshold is a lot lower than other demands, like social justice demands. I also think a non-disruptive action is one that literally does not disrupt, like, the status quo. I think, like, mass mobilizations that we've done in terms of, like, rallies, walkouts, etc., have been, like, super like useful in building like a sense of community and solidarity and like building that momentum. But at this point, I think we are pivoting towards disrupting the status quo.
Yeah, so thank you so much. We're going to take a short music break. Do you guys have any song requests? maybe in the spirit of Palestine solidarity or not. Really, you guys have so much choice here. Yeah. So a lot of freedom to pick what listeners listen to in the next 3 minutes or so. A lot of power.
Yeah.
You can just tell us the name.
Do Sindibad.
How do you spell that?
S-I-N-D-I-bad.
Bad.
I-bad.
Bad. Sindibad. Wait.
Maybe go on YouTube.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Give us a minute.
What's the artist? Is that the artist name or is it the song?
No, that's the song name. Okay. The artist is Shabjeet.
Oh, yes. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, amazing.
Okay, do you want to give a little like intro to the song?
I mean, it goes pretty hard. I think you're gonna love it. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. That's all we need to know. Okay, so here is Sindibad.
شرن لباجي غاد مش بعد حجر صبح زي مساي وسط زي حكايتي مستعجل بس بضطر شفتك وانت جاي هادي مش هوايتي شاف مصدر منه استرزا ننساش اللي يتعدانا بدور القلب تتخزى كن صاحب صاحبك صاحب المبدا لي يوم يلزم ما بيتردد لي ما بتندم يوم يفزع لك لي لو توقع دايما جنبك تتهبل ننساش العشره وما بنخسرها عجبك بالفزعه واو وانا مال ومال الناس بلعك قرش مش كساس مش ان يوم شفت وضق عليك تزعل زي في ملان بلدنا مبنكة في ملان وان شاء الله الجمعة في كمان وكل مين شاف شاب جديد على المسرح بيستغرب وينا من زمان وكوينك من زمان شفت بعينك الامان شوف بطمن لك حصتك بس شرطك كنت حكينا هنا جاك اذا عجبك شرط ما هلا جاك خلصنا تفضلوا على العشاء نطلع استج مش على المسرح وقته ضدو هضحك كلام ترك من الجو فانا موكس مني جوا بلعبوا فيها عداء انا بلعبها قوة هي هرم من الوزن يا زين يوم اتمارس كل متزين يوم بزعل بتزعزع من جوا ليش لاني انا فارغ من الجو فانا ناقص مني جوا كلكم بتلعبوا فيها عداء انا بلعبها قوة هي هرم من الوزن يا زين يوم اتمارس كل متزين بزعل لو بتزعلني ويوم بزعل بتزعزع من جوا ضلني ساكت طول الوقت انا تتحسر حظك حظ كلاب حذر فذر سد الباب سندي راحت سندي جاء وانا سندي بادي بادي شغلي ماشي ماشي شرطة شافني ماشي رحت اتفتى شي مساك بضغط شرطة شكله بطش اللي بيعرفوني وقت اتنرفز يلا الحقوني رحت اتمركز لما يمسكوني نام بالمركز غد بتدلل البتر هتبرتاح نام بسكوني بفيك وانا بجهز نيكوز انا كرز لانه مصيره نيكوز انا كرز مش منطق تتملق وانت بتسرح بمنطق ديه نسيب اذا بتزل لما تجيني بجيك ولا بسأل عندي يقيني في حذر فذر سد الباب سند راحت سند جاء وانا سندباد عمري ماشي ماشي رن لباجي غاد مش بتحجر صبح زي مساي وسط زي حكايتي مستعجل بس بضطر شفتك وانت جاي هادي مش هوايتي شاف مصدر منه استرزا ننساش اللي يتعدانا بدور القلب تتخزى كن صاحب صاحبك صاحب المبدا لي يوم يلزم ما بيتردد لي ما بتندم يوم يفزع لك لي لو توقع دايما جنبك تتهبل ننساش العشره وما بنخسرها عجبك بالفزعه واو
لازم دباد دباد عمري ماشي ماشي رن لباد.
Okay, hello, we are back. You're listening to Off the Hour with the News Collective, CKUT. Today we're joined by representatives from SPHR, IJV, and Divest. Thank you so much again for...
Oh, and McGill students.
Oh, sorry.
Grad students
for
Palestine, too.
Oops, I'm so sorry. Grad students for Palestine as well. Yeah, and we just finished talking about the Brafman blockade this last Thursday on the 22nd, and just about the academic boycott and divestment demands that students have been bringing forth to administration on campus recently. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you guys about kind of like cynicism for a lot of students, like Deep Saini's email and the administration's refusal to meet with student groups might just be another reason to say that the administration is not going to budge on this. You know, like they've stated clearly to everybody that they're not going to divest or boycott. For those who are doubtful that protesting will change anything, why are you guys hopeful, and why do you see these goals of boycott and divestment as a feasible objective?
I just wanted to touch upon the fact that very recently, the BDS movement published that students at UC San Diego won a very hard-fought victory in securing divestment for their university. And I think when we're talking about feasibility, we need to keep in mind these examples and the examples of the past to remind us that even though we are facing this opposition, that they clearly seem diametrically opposed to everything we stand for and our objectives. Like, that is just a cross-section of what is a broader march towards eventual victory, and we have the momentum, and obviously hope is very complicated and a very, like, intrinsic aspect of that process, but, like, it is feasible, it is real, and we will make it happen, but not out of fate, not out of accident, but because of determination and consistency over time.
Actually, I did just quickly on that.
Oh, yeah.
Was it divestment from... like Israeli kind of investments, or like what was the divestment exactly?
Yeah, so the BDS movement website says that explicitly it was a resolution for divestment from companies profiting from Israeli occupation.
Okay. Wow. And does anyone want to speak to the divestment efforts at McGill? Like, is that an ongoing thing on the economic side of things?
I mean, I can speak to a recent academic boycott, like, victory on campus. So it's pretty, like, tangential to the effort that was done at Brafman. But this was actually in the arts union. So academic boycotts, there's a lot of power in, like, student governance to implement them, as opposed to, like, administrative governance. And we have, like, a precedent on campus for these types of boycotts within the Art Student Union. Because under Quebec law, a new course or course changes that include a fee increase need to be approved by, like, the corresponding faculty association, so, like, AUS, SUS, whatever that might be. And, like, students sitting on these boards actually have the power to block or, like, veto a course. So the first time this happened was... I think around 2020 or 2019, when the AUS board essentially vetoed a fee increase for Poly 339. And that was a comparative history course that sent students to Israel. And so the current team was, like, did a huge effort to build on that precedent. And they recently adopted a mandate to reject all course fees, all course fee approvals for courses in collaboration with the state of Israel. So they're setting, like, a mandate for the future, which I think is amazing. And they don't currently have an active course, so I think, like, efforts to submit one will be, like, blocked. And without that, like, AUS approval, the course can't move forward under Quebec law. So I think it's a huge win for, like, an academic boycott on campus. And I think the more, like, faculty associations adopt this, like, the more that, like, we can operate outside this, like, the scope of the policy against genocide. Like, people can take on their own initiatives within their, like, little fronts. And I think we're seeing that happen, which is amazing.
Is the same process, like, also followed for the courses that you mentioned, like the finance courses and the was it the FACC course, like, mm-hmm. what kind of, you know, like, what kind of process would go through, like, disrupting that?
So I think for courses that have been established, unless there's, like, a renewal in the fee, it would be, like, a motion like this wouldn't target that. So pressure would be where you would you would focus, like, on a course that is existing. I mean, there can be, like, motions passed within, like, the, I believe, the EDUS, the Engineering Student Union, to condemn such courses. So if the course is present and it's kind of, like, stationary, like, there can be a huge, like, internal push to condemn such a course that, like, the faculty offers. But I assume that it did go through the same process. So the EUS, if it had adopted such a mandate, wouldn't have approved the course. Same with the Management Association.
Yeah. Oh, do you want to add something?
Oh, yeah. So I was just going to, like, to summarize, like, as per your question, where is the hope in terms of seeing an academic boycott occur in light of Deep Saini's email? It really is occurring, and so it's hard not to be hopeful when you can see it in motion. And you can see different groups take on that responsibility that they feel they have and that they know they have on campus to sever any ties with Israeli institutions that are propping up a genocide.
And yeah, speaking of, like, the organizing side of this goal, I know the blockade was an effort between a lot of different student groups that were in this coalition together. How was, like, that formed, and how did you guys make those connections? Like, can you speak a bit about that?
So there were groups that, like, had a, like, there was, like, a legacy of collaboration between SPHR and, like, several groups that were involved, like, Sorry Divest. And then, like, new groups popped up. Like, since October, we've seen groups like Grad Students for Palestine, Law Students for Palestine, Engineers for Palestine, just kind of, like, emerge within their own, like, little, like, spaces. And, like, yeah, those connections were also built. And it was great. Like, I mean, so it was, like, groups that we had already been working with and, like, new groups that, like, popped up. And, like, there's sort of, like, a coalition on campus now, which is, I think, really, like, great.
And I think this emergence of groups really speaks to, like, how natural and normal a response to a genocide is. Like, organizing is what feels right, what feels normal, and what feels, like, necessary at this moment. And I think a lot of people are just responding to that. And so we see academic boycott and divestment similarly as very normal and natural responses in light of this depravity and in light of this violence.
If I can add to that, the words of the martyr Aaron Bushnell, who engaged in a extremely powerful act of self-immolation in front of the Zionist embassy, his words to me really ring out, kind of in the same vein of what Sara was getting at, which is, you know, many of us like to ask ourselves, what would I do if I were alive during apartheid? The answer is, you're doing it right now. And so for me, I don't feel like I really have a choice but to show up, because anything other would be a violation of all of the values that I stand for human rights, the Jewish values that I learned of B'Tselem Elohim, everyone being born as an equal human, Tikkun Olam, working to heal the world as a collective effort. My values compel me to be there, and I want to be there when there is a genocide occurring, because I don't have the option not to.
Thanks for sharing that. We just have a couple minutes left before Wendy's going to, again, introduce a little segment that she did about the hunger strikers at McGill. But my last question for you guys would be, you know, speaking of the kind of broad coalition organizing that's happening across campuses, across Canada, across the world, really, you know, like, what is... Have there been any victories that have been, like, particularly captivating, or have you seen anything that's really inspired you, like, specific actions, specific, you know, organizations that are doing really good work? Like, what's catching your eye? What's keeping you inspired and motivated?
I think specifically for the blockade, I know the work by the Palestinian Youth Movement mm-hmm. in New York City was really inspiring. Mm-hmm. They successfully shut down, I think, all four major highways mm-hmm. in and out of the island.
Yeah.
And really the work of Palestinian Youth Movement across North America mm-hmm. Has continued to impress and support resistance yeah. elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like to shout out Pal Action, who's probably doing, like, the hardest work, like, within the movement. Like, they're really putting their bodies on the line to disrupt, mm-hmm. like, the flow mm-hmm. of capital and, like, factories that literally build the weapons that are sent to yeah. commit war crimes. So yeah. I think that's also been an effort that's been super inspiring.
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you so much, to our guests for speaking with us. I feel like I learned a lot about the divestment and boycott movement on campus, and I really, appreciate all these like shout outs and this message of hope that we're leaving with. I'm going to play an interview that I did with some of the hunger strikers. They were Bogdan, Annette, and B. It's very kind of unedited, so bear with the unedited kind of mishaps of that. But yeah, we're going to play that.
Hi, I'm B. I'm a relay hunger striker, so I strike every week for at least 24 hours. What motivated me to start hunger striking is I've been seeing online so many Palestinians who are severely lacking food and aid because it stopped coming in, and so I'm very empathetic to their suffering, and so I want to make stuff change at the level that is closest to me, which is my school.
Yes, this idea was actually proposed by a Palestinian student that we were initially just throwing ideas around with, and I thought that it was an excellent idea and that it's a necessary, unprecedented action to an unprecedented situation. Why I think hunger striking and striking more generally is necessary is because we want to help people on the ground now, as soon as possible, by the end of the semester. And there's already been so many tactics that have been employed by McGill students. We've had protests and sit-ins and blockades and teach-ins and votes and referenda and petitions and letters and talks with administration. All of this has been tried. And we felt that we could, with this hunger strike, add another additional element of pressure to get the administration to divest as soon as possible. And we thought that it would be possible to make it happen now, because there's precedence. It happened in 1985 for the South African apartheid. We divested 50 million. That's worth 100 million today. We divested again from fossil fuels just last semester. That was 50 million. And both of these movements took up took a lot of time, took a lot of buildup over a decade, but the same thing has been happening with pro-Palestinian students on campus, with SPHR's advocacy on campus, and now we've reached really an intense point of mobilization. A lot of people are involved, so we thought that we could amp it up a little bit even more and get these results this semester to help people on the ground now. And the last thing I want to add is that in 85, when there was the divestment from South African apartheid, students were also hunger striking. Even though there's no written record of it anywhere, we are hoping to get that for y'all soon. But we do have confirmation from an internal source to the McGill administration that there was in fact a hunger strike back then. So if it worked then, it can work now. Oh, I forgot to mention, yes, my name is Bogdan, and I'm one of the indefinite hunger strikers. I'm now on day 11 of the indefinite hunger strike. Strikes in general, I would say, are just great, because what they permit us to do is to build like community relationships with each other. In our collective refusal to participate in a certain system, we also not only are we completely disabling the system itself, right? Because by not actively participating in it, let's say students not going to class, or workers not going to work, or tenants not paying rent, this is the foundation on which our whole exploitative colonial structures work. Without people actively partaking in them, they cannot continue to work. So this is really, the strikes in general are the strongest tool that anyone has in their arsenal, so long as they're able to organize it. And strikes are also great because they simultaneously give people the time to and the motivation to build more horizontal, more equal relationships with each other, and to essentially begin the work of replacing the structure of one institution with one that is more grassroots and popular and egalitarian and horizontal and non-hierarchical. So I personally really believe that strikes are the way to...
'Cause I don't think we as students count more than Palestinian students in Palestine. I think we all have the same right to education. So I don't think I should just go to class. UPD, great, my country is not being affected by a genocide. Let's just go on. I don't think I should have that luxury when they don't have it.
So yeah, on that note, like, what is it like being a student and hunger striking? Like how do you take care of yourselves? Do you have to tell professors or like your friends, stuff like that?
It's really hard because despite the referendum on the policy against genocide achieving over 76%, 78% of students agreeing to that policy, it's a topic that's been very shushed. And it's really hard as students, due to the hierarchy, to talk about it with our professors. And there's no trusting relationship. So I think it's just really hard for me to open up and talk about it. And just hunger striking as a student, especially if you're an international student or you live alone, it's really hard to take care of yourself. But thanks to our amazing team and this community building that we're trying to do, we have caretakers, we have healthcare professionals who are there to support us. I think that it wouldn't be possible without them. So despite all the obstacles, I think that this just shows how, when people are working towards a cause that, you know, aligns with compassionate values, it's really possible to make a change. And it is, like one of our slogans, it is absolutely possible and necessary for us to achieve these demands of divesting and cutting academic ties with Israel.
Hunger striking while being a student sucks massively. I think about food all the time. I'm in class and literally I have to constantly bring my thoughts back to what is being said, because the minute I'm not actively listening to what the teacher is saying or typing, I immediately go back to food. Yeah, so it sucks. It's super hard. I have nothing else to say.
Yeah, it's for me, it's been at it for 11 days. The level of hunger is not the same as it was the first days. That being said, just the fatigue and... yeah, just not thinking as quickly as I would usually, and the irritability. I feel like emotionally it's difficult. That being said, the one professor that I have for my last seminar as part of my MA is supportive, so I have help on that front. But just getting through the motions of doing your readings and just going to class and getting on the bus every day and then doing the chores that you need to do at home, it's a lot to do when you're not eating, and it is exhausting, and I'm just constantly having to take naps, but I'm still trying to find energy to organize, and we're hoping that the more organized we get, the closer the university will be to seeing reason and to doing the right thing.
What would you guys tell somebody who is very like cynical about the administration budging on this issue? Like, I feel like because you guys are striking, like, you have a lot of hope in your hearts that they will change their minds and or like let the referendum pass through. So can you tell me a bit about that?
We wouldn't be striking if we thought there was no end in sight. We wouldn't be striking if we think if we thought that the administration is never gonna budge, they're never gonna change their ways, because we don't want to die. We don't want to die. So I am filled with hope. You know, I do see the university becoming a better place for all students.
I think Bogdan has the exact numbers, but it's absolutely possible to divest, because right now we are at, I think, 20 million. And it's not that big of a number compared to other divestments that McGill has done in the past, like divesting from the from South Africa and divesting from fossil fuels last December. So it is absolutely possible. And I think this is really just a matter of McGill recognizing their active participation in the genocide, because I don't think this is a money issue anymore, as it is not as big, like, it is not the biggest amount we're asking for them to divest.
As was already stated, I think there was clear precedent for the administration being convinced to do something. So in that sense, I don't think it's impossible. But another kind of cynicism that I hear a lot and I would like to address is that it can't be done at McGill because the students are too international, they're too well off, it's too privileged of an institution, and people want to hold on to what they have. And I would like to counter to that two things. First of all, that McGill, actually, compared to other universities in Montreal, has been quite well organized on this, especially since October. We've had a number of students group pop up supporting the demands of boycott and divestment. We've had law students for Palestine and engineers for Palestine and healthcare students for Palestine and grad students for Palestine. And, of course, there was SPHR that was there since the beginning. And now we also even have us, McGill Hunger Strikers, and Student Justice for Palestine. Palestine McGill, which is a non-hierarchical and intersectional pro-Palestine group on campus. So we have all these groups popping up. We've had all of these votes. We've had the undergraduate referendum, which was 78%. We've had the graduates pass motions in the postgraduate student assembly. Just overwhelming the amount of people who showed up and who voted in favor of motions calling on the PGSS to pressure the administration to divest and boycott. And on top of that, we've had supportive faculty. So faculty signed at least two letters in support of the subject, 90 of them together. And when we reached out to faculty to see if they can help us, they've been very supportive, and we're hoping to continue working with them. So again, the organization on campus has been actually very well done compared, I think, to even to other campuses. And secondly, no matter where you're organizing, people are always going to give you a reason why you can't do it where you are. So whether you're in a less well-off part of the world, people say, no, well, you can't do it here because it's too rough here. People are too beaten down. They don't have enough opportunities to be able to do it. And if you go to the West, people tell you, well, it's too decadent here. People are too well off. They're too self-satisfied. But I really believe that wherever you are, that's where you need to organize, and it can be done. There might be slightly different variations on how that's achieved, but at the end of the day, these institutions can be deconstructed and reconstructed the way that we want them to be.
Thank you. Thank you.